Hello and welcome to this week's Key Voices. I'm Caroline Doherty. We will no longer be including the week's headlines in our podcasts, but I encourage you to visit resources.thekeysupport.com/newsbriefing and sign up for our news briefing, a weekly education sector roundup delivered to your inbox every Friday. Today, I am joined by my colleague, Nicola West-Jones, who conducted our recent research into trust growth, trust expansion, overcoming growing pains. Welcome, Nicola.
Hello.
So we're just going to talk a little bit about the report and some of the observations from your conversations with trust leaders over the last little while. Can you tell us a bit about how you conducted the research?
Yeah, sure. So we ran this report and this research in partnership with Forum Strategy. They, for those of you that aren't aware, are a national group of trust leaders who try to support each other through networks and their own research projects and conferences, that kind of thing. And we thought they would be an excellent partner to work with on this. So we first of all ran three focus groups in conjunction with them. They comprised CEOs mainly. We also had a few other people like CFOs and some procurement people and people that were working as leaders in schools as well as on the central team. And we ran these focus groups in London, Liverpool and Nottingham. And we really used them to tease out some of the opportunities and challenges that were being faced by those trusts. And we got them to talk very openly and importantly, very anonymously to really get their feelings. And then once we'd pulled those together, we started to notice across the three groups some commonalities, some synergies between the three focus groups, which we then turned into a bigger survey. And that survey was sent to around 9,000 leaders of academy trusts and leaders of schools in academy trusts. And we encouraged them to share that with people in the central team. So we had a response rate from that. We had something like 179 people that filled that in, and we lost a few along the way. So we got down to 155, but they were very qualified people in the sense that they had key roles in the central team. Mm. So for example, we had 49 chief executives in that sample. Mm. And yeah, they filled in that survey for us. It was quite a lengthy survey, about 10 minutes. And from that, we then began to analyse and validate what was being said in the focus groups with the findings from the survey.
Fantastic. And sort of, can you give us a flavour of what the report reveals about the challenges associated with growing a trust?
Yeah, I mean, unsurprisingly, growth was the biggest focus amongst the discussion panels, the discussion groups. So they had lots to share on this. Everybody was up for growth. I think we found that 54% in the survey said they were currently growing, and whether that's acquiring new schools right now or planning a merger or actively seeking other schools, there's this predominant 54% who are doing that right now. And then a further 28% wanted to grow, but when the time was right, and often that was down to the right school with the right ethos and shared vision coming along at the right time. Only 4% said they didn't want to grow. And we found that people started talking very openly about some of the challenges involved in growth. And it really came down to, well, firstly, this kind of problem of geography, that the further away the schools they wanted to acquire were, or a potential merger with another MAT might be, the further away those schools or other trusts were, the bigger the problem. People talk to us about one of the great benefits of being in a trust is the ability to get school leaders and actually teachers, right down to nursery teachers, EYFS staff, getting those people to come together regularly. And obviously that's very difficult if you're having to get in a car and drive great distances or jump on a train to meet those people. So it was really something that they felt was working only if those schools were fairly local to each other. And that was a real concern for them, that growth had to be a kind of locally based growth.
I suppose that's tricky, actually, because if you're going to give parents and pupils choice, you can't just have all the schools in one area all part of the same trust, perhaps. So it's a kind of, there's something about being near enough to each other geographically, but you know, a bit further away sometimes.
Well, we do know trusts, obviously, who are very close to each other and dominate a local area. Mm. And I think not going to speculate, but you know, there are potentially issues with provision in that area in terms of parental choice. But it was more around this kind of sense of, one of the great benefits is for staff and their ability to collaborate, to do everything from shared planning, moderation, to plan the curriculum, to plan assessment, to share best practice with each other, and also lots around school improvement. The idea that you can create hubs or networks of four or five people all doing the same job, where perhaps there is one weaker colleague or one newer to teaching. Mm. And just networking those people physically and locally allows school improvement to happen at a local level without really much intervention from the central team. So yeah, the geography thing was one. There was another concern, which was felt by 51% of respondents, so over half, around this idea of what happens to the existing schools in the trust if new schools come along. Is your attention going to be taken away from your existing schools, which might have taken a while to get to that state where everybody is all operating very nicely. They might have done a lot of school improvement and trust improvement to get to that point. And then, the RSC, the Regional Schools Commissioner, comes along with a school at what might be a potentially bad time or potentially just not the right fit of a school, or just actually the timing's right, the school is right, it's just a very challenging school to take on. Mm. And there was this fear that their attention was going to be diverted to incoming schools with more challenges and the negative effect that existing schools might feel.
Yeah, I imagine, especially with funding, a lot of trusts feeling like they actually haven't got capacity to spare at the centre, that everybody's kind of committed to their fullest extent, and then you don't just have spare people who can go and support a school straight away, as you say, particularly if the timing is difficult.
Or absolutely, it's not just doing the due diligence piece; it's the stuff that has to happen before that, even we get to that stage. You know, it's literally those kind of early conversations and that time spent with those incoming schools. That all takes up a lot of time. And we know these people are extremely stretched. There is very little capacity, especially in these trusts that have, you know, the kind of average size trusts, the trusts with maybe 1 to 5 schools or 2 to 5 schools. There isn't really, I mean, there are exceptions. We definitely spoke to some where their central team was maybe 12 people and with, you know, 7 or 8 schools. We also spoke to trusts of the same size where there was 1.5 people in that central team. So they do vary in that size. And, you know, it's about the offer to schools, really, what they get for their money. But yeah.
And what did, in terms of growth, what did you learn about the size that those schools, those trusts, sorry, that are growing, planning to get to? What's the kind of ideal size?
Yeah, well, we asked this question. Really, the question was framed around what would be the ideal size of the trust in order for the trust to fulfil its vision and its strategy. And we got a real mixed picture here. So we banded those sizes of trusts into 2 to 5, 4 to 5, 6 to 10, 11 to 15, 16 to 20. And then we went up in increments of 10 from there. And we had a really mixed picture. So there wasn't a kind of clear pattern, although the majority said that 6 to 10 schools would be ideal. But what was really interesting was when we broke that down by the current size of that trust. So when we looked at where they were at now and where they wanted to be, we did see this pattern emerging. And that pattern was basically they wanted to be the next size up from their current size in order to fulfill the vision. So one thing we could deduce from that is they're not currently fulfilling their vision. They need more schools in order to fulfill their vision. But also this sense that the bigger the trust grows, almost the bigger it wants to get. And what was interesting was that when we actually asked why it was they wanted to get to the next size up, there was a pattern that emerged. So those schools that wanted to get to 6 to 10 schools, they were predominantly interested in this kind of sense of economies of scale and financial viability. And then we looked at the trust that wanted to get to the next size up, 11 to 15 schools. And they were talking, there was a theme around financial viability, but they started talking around the idea of regional hubs. So being able to say, okay, well, if we've got 15 schools, maybe we can have three hubs of five, and maybe we can put one person on school improvement in each hub, or maybe we can cluster those hubs around a geography. So that was what they were interested in. And they just needed more schools to in order to do that kind of that hub model. And then finally, the trust that wanted to get to the 16 to 20 were really interested in buying in and recruiting specialist staff in that central team. So they were talking about, for example, ed psychs, educational psychologists, and how brilliant it would be if they could employ somebody to really understand the ethos of the trust and to work with the schools that they already had, rather than buying in consultants, which obviously can be more expensive.
So it's really at that top group that are looking more at that kind of economies of scale.
In terms of really maximizing, well, if we've got enough schools, we can start doing some really clever things. We can start, almost you're bringing in people to the team to take on the ethos of the whole trust, rather than buying in piecemeal a school improvement advisor here that you might be sharing with other trusts or other schools. You can start to bring people in-house. And I think that's something quite exciting about being able to do that. They're almost becoming kind of mini local authorities in that sense.
And what would you say from your conversations with trust leaders and your findings in the report, what would you say are their kind of main priorities just now?
Well, we asked them to pick their top three priorities for the academic year, and it probably doesn't come as a surprise to anybody listening to this that finances and curriculum top the priority list for this year. So on the finance side, that's really about the budget and raising income at that level. And that might be raising income through bringing in other schools, or it might be raising income through, you know, traditional fundraising or just dealing with budget cuts. So that was felt, but that was a priority for over half. And then the second one was around curriculum. And that's, you know, really about consolidating the curriculum. So we weren't really surprised by that, given changes in the sector to do with the integrated curriculum financial planning. We thought that's probably driving this to a degree because that relates to funding. We also know that just changes to the Ofsted inspection framework are going to have a huge impact on, and then picking that. But you know, this is a great opportunity for Trust, the new inspection framework. They've got this ability through their scale to really do something quite exciting with their curriculum plans across the Trust. So we weren't surprised that was high up their priority list. I guess what we were maybe more surprised at was what was lower down their list. And the focus groups talked a lot about community and how important it was to be really part of your community and the benefits to a community of a trust. But we actually found that is really low down the list for priorities in terms of this current academic year. Maybe that's not surprising because of the current state of play with most trusts and schools' finances, and this, as I say, this curriculum change. But yeah, community was really low.
Yeah, it's interesting with the finance and curriculum. That would probably be the same if you'd surveyed a group of schools that weren't in trusts.
Yeah, sure.
Kind of quite prevalent across the sector. Was there anything particular on the priorities list of trust leaders that really speaks to their role across a group of schools?
I mean, I think not particularly, but I think this issue of community is also really, I guess, does relate to this inability for some of them to be in many places at once, quite physically. So the focus groups were a bit divided actually in this regard. So there was on one hand this feeling of actually trust shouldn't have a role in communities and community engagement. It's down to the schools to do that. And actually somebody that told us that was in a trust of between 6 and 10 schools. And those schools were quite spread out geographically. So as far as they were concerned, the sense of, you know, the idea of a community for 6 to 10 schools that are all over the place is really hard to pin down. You know, how are you going to, you know, how's the trust going to have any impact on those, you know, 7 or 8 different communities? But then on the other side of the coin, we had actually bigger trusts, and I think smaller trusts would say the same things. Trusts with maybe 3 or 4 schools locally, but also those bigger trusts that can do this kind of hub model of clustering people, clustering schools around a local area. They were really keen on this ability to support and engage with communities. They talked about things like supporting mums with English as an additional language, or working with the community on climate change initiatives, things that would be really hard to do at the trust level if you weren't physically located in a local geography.
Yeah, and you've got some data on their priorities, but what did you learn about the kind of motivations of the people who are running trusts?
Yeah, well, we're interested in this because, I mean, you'll be aware that there's lots in the press around, and in the media, around trust leaders. Certain sections of the press and the media like to paint trust leaders or trust CEOs as this kind of fat cat, greedy kind of corporate entity, which is all about, you know, how much money can the central team make, how much money can the CEO make. And we knew, because we work closely with trust, that just isn't really reality for most trust leaders. And we were really delighted, actually, to meet some of these amazing people and see in the flesh how amazingly ethical they are. They really did not talk in that language. They didn't talk about growth for growth's sake. They were very committed to two things, really. One was raising the outcome, or improving the outcomes for and the progress for pupils. So kind of beating their own targets by providing an excellent education for the children in their care. And then the second thing that really motivated them, you know, the kind of what do you get out of bed for question, if you like, was around making the schools in the trust really inspiring places to come and work if you're a teacher or member of staff, and learn if you're a pupil. And it really wasn't part of their kind of ideology to just be growing or scaling their work because their work is so brilliant that it needs to be kind of brought to the masses. That just wasn't really what was happening, we found.
And what did you learn about the benefits as trust leaders see them of being in a trust?
So we asked a question firstly around what were they doing to make themselves an employer of choice. And I guess I was personally quite interested in this answer. I wondered whether, so we've seen this in the press, whether there might be stories around, well, you know, we provide these gym memberships at discounted rate, or we're, you know, helping employees to get a foot on the housing ladder, we're providing loans, or, you know, all these things that you might expect. And that was really not what we saw at all. It was about 3%, I think, of our sample that were doing anything like that. What they were doing, though, was providing amazing CPD opportunities for their staff. So we heard about, well, one example was from a trust. I think they had, they were in the 6 to 10 school band, and they were doing 10-year career plans with every single member of staff. That's teaching staff, wow, support staff, TAs. They really wanted to understand, you know, what was the 10-year plan like? Whether that person, you know, carried out that plan with that trust, yeah, didn't matter. They were very keen to find out what motivated them and where they wanted to get to. And I think that was when we then asked the question around the benefits for teaching staff, that came out really strongly, that these career pathways were something that are unique to trusts. And it's very difficult if you are a single school, whether you're maintained or an academy, to offer that level of career progression, that you can spot opportunities in neighbouring schools for people to progress, for people to be mentored, for people to get support in areas that they're weak. So we saw lots of examples there. And generally it was around benefits to staff, included lots of sharing best practice, these kind of network effects of weaker staff being supported by stronger staff, peer work, so the opportunity for staff to work on, say, management challenges that they might ordinarily not get the chance to do in a single school, but, you know, to be able to work with colleagues in other schools to work on discrete projects was just something that they talked a lot about.
Great. And I guess there's more opportunities to really share challenges and issues because you're all part of the same team and you don't have that worry of kind of showing your dirty laundry or some sort of issue in your school to somebody else.
Absolutely. That kind of the thing around competition doesn't really exist. You know, we didn't hear of schools feeling like they were in competition with other schools in their trust. It felt like a very collaborative place to be. And, you know, also an opportunity to specialise. So if you are in a primary school, if you are, let's say, a humanities lead, you can really start honing that that subject and your skills within it by working across many different schools, almost like you would if you were working in a secondary school. You know, you become very expert in something because you are the expert across seven or eight schools. You know, that's a powerful thing for somebody that's really interested in a particular subject. And I know, quite different from, say, one form entry single primary schools, whether they are maintained or academy, where, you know, everybody has a subject leadership role, and because there's a lot of churn in those subject leadership roles, so you might not necessarily be the most informed about science, but you might suddenly find yourself a science subject leader for the whole school. Well, that just doesn't seem to be happening in trusts.
Interesting. Now, obviously, we had to keep the survey manageable, and there are all sorts of other things we could have kind of dived into with our research. But from your kind of conversations with the focus groups or other observations that you've made while you did this research, is there anything else that you'd really like to investigate about trusts?
We didn't really touch on governance, and I think I'd have liked to have done something on that and like to do something on that again. And then there were just little niche areas that I'd love to probe on further. So somebody was talking about gag pooling. So that's, for those not aware, the kind of model where you literally pool all your money together, all your budgets together across the trust. And that's something that the DfE, I think, has recommended. But very few people seem to have done that. And there was a lot of interest, actually, in the focus groups around, we'd like to try this, but there's just no model for it. And we're not really prepared to be the first ones to give it a go. We want to see how somebody else does it first before we make that leap.
Big commitment.
It is a big commitment. And, you know, I'm sure there's been lots of studies to show the benefits of this, but I think people feel until it's been done and done sustainably and without any collateral damage, they want to see examples of somebody doing it very successfully. And I think I'd love to do some more work around that.
Great. It's fascinating to hear more about this report. We'll put a link so that people can download it and have a read in the description of this podcast. But thank you very much, Nicola.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you very much for listening. Key Voices is produced by The Key, giving education leaders the knowledge to act. Members of The Key for School Leaders can access hundreds of articles on the latest issues in education at thekeysupport.com.